I grew up in a shop, and the threat of the National Front was ever present. Mm. You never knew who was going to come through the door and sort of knife your parents or whatever.
In those early days, it was a real battle to do something other than what I was supposed to do, yeah, because I wasn't seen as a face that rock music should have.
There's always this push, isn't there, between what is mainstream and what is marginal. Sadly, you know, the marginal stuff is often the most exciting. The wide on that camera is lovely with the clouds. I'm Gurinder Chadha. I'm a writer, director, producer.
Cards!
My name is Skin, and I'm the lead singer and songwriter of multi-million selling British rock band Skunk Anansie, and I'm also a DJ.
Both Skin and I are second-generation immigrants who had to deal with our fair share of racism and sexism growing up.
Your sister's getting engaged and you're sitting here watching this skinhead boy.
Gurinder's films are huge box office hits, but she has never compromised on her message, empowering women, challenging racism, and giving a voice to people of colour.
I still remember Skin's arrival on the rock scene. She was one of the first black women to front a rock band. She was audacious, she was fearless, she was just incredible.
As women, we've both forged new paths in the worlds of cinema and music, calling for equality, diversity, and inclusion.
We share so many influences and experiences. I'm really looking forward to talking to her. Skin, what an absolute honour to meet you, a fellow Londoner like me.
I feel the same way. I feel there's so many paths of ours that seem to cross a lot.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm thrilled that you've published your memoir.
Yes.
It Takes Blood and Guts. Why now?
In the 90s, you know, everything was so fast and there was so much going on. And if you were a kid growing up now and you were reflecting on the 90s, you would think it was just a white male-dominated era full of, like, boy bands and boy rock bands, and there was nothing else going on. Mm. But actually, my impression of the 90s and what was happening at that time was, like, you know, drum and bass was huge.
Yes.
R&B was huge. Yes. So it was a heavy metal market.
Yes.
And I think that in some ways, those things were kind of more representative and more important and have been more influential and more inspiring,
yes,
than Britpop, in my opinion. I always say you can draw a line from Goldie to Stormzy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And on the way you get to dubstep and two-step and all these musical styles.
Yes.
That, and I think that sound is much more influential to what's going on now. So if you think about racism, the biggest weapon they have is making us invisible or making what we've done invisible.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if I don't write it and if I don't jump on it, then nobody's going to. And it's like,
absolutely,
we didn't exist.
Absolutely. I think it's
very important. What do you remember of that
well,
time?
Well, when you say Britpop, of course, everyone thinks of Blur
and Oasis.
Oasis. And possibly Spice Girls. You know?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But you're right. What was really going on, as you say, with Goldie and the beginnings of all the kind of,
yeah,
what was then called underground music scene of Britain, particularly London,
yeah,
you know, has stayed the course, you know. And it was Dizzy who represented us at the
yeah,
Olympics, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a
yeah,
proud moment for all of us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, there's always this push, isn't there, between what is mainstream and what is marginal.
Yeah.
And sadly, you know, the marginal stuff is often the most exciting and innovative, you know, and gets lost because it's so easy to use labels.
Do you think it's because, you know, our world is a world that we have had to be, you know, fighters and battle to actually get in there? You know, for me, in those early days, it was a real battle to do something other than what I was supposed to do,
yeah,
because of I wasn't seen as a face that rock music should have.
Absolutely, yeah.
So,
well, I made three films in the 90s.
Yeah.
My first film, Barge on the Beach, was 93. And you're absolutely right. I mean, that's not our domain. I wasn't supposed to be a filmmaker. I had a careers teacher at school who, when I said I want to go to university, said, oh, I really think you should try secretarial college.
What is it with careers teachers in the 90s? I went to my careers teacher and it was the first person I blurted out my wildest dreams. I wanted to be a photojournalist. I wanted to be in a jumpsuit jumping out of a helicopter with a big camera saying, where's the action?
Yeah.
And I told her all these dreams. And then she very slowly pushed this form in front of me. She said, well, why don't you think about this first? And I looked down and it was an application form for Woolworths.
Oh, no.
And I was like, well, I'm already working at Woolworths as a Saturday job.
Yeah.
What's with that, you know?
Well, I think the biggest surprise, even after 30 years of filmmaking, is people's expectations of what you can actually do compared to what they think you can do.
Mm.
And yes, that careers teacher was wrong because, but I thank her because as soon as she said, you need to be a secretary, that spurred me on to say, well, I'll show you. And I've constantly had this, like, well, I'll show you
attitude. What was your next step after that?
I went to university. Before that, though, what had started happening with me, sort of late 70s, you know, I was around during the Troubles, if you like, or the riots, you know, in London and Manchester and Birmingham, I mean, everywhere. And I had a kind of a political awakening, basically. I grew up in a shop and the threat of the National Front was ever present.
Mm.
You never knew who was going to come through the door and sort of knife your parents or whatever. I mean, it was always there.
The tension.
There had been an NF march in Lewisham and people we knew, shopkeepers, who'd been beaten up and all their doors smashed. And so when Rock Against Racism started, for me, it was like, oh, this is the first kind of public, youthful response to the National Front, a sort of collective thing.
And that was your turning point.
And that was one of my turning points. And I remember when the New Cross fire happened, which was a terrible event where these black teenagers were all having a party and somebody firebombed the house.
Yeah,
and, of course, it all went up in flames.
Yeah.
And I went on the march, and it was the first march I went on, was the New Cross Fire March.
Mm.
And I remember going, you know, with all these people who were angry, and they were young people, British-born people of, you know, black, Asian, whatever. And that gave me a real sense of strength, actually, being on that march against the racism. I felt a lot more empowered.
I'm from Brixton, so the Brixton riots is the thing that really kind of made me political. That's where I got my first sense of identity from, because I remember being very small and not feeling English at all. And it's because the society I was living in and everything I saw in the news and whatever, you know, you're not English, you're not English, you're black, so you're not from here, you're from wherever your parents are from.
Mm.
And I remember feeling very Jamaican. I always had my little patois down, you know what I mean? And yeah, yes, man. And then I went to Jamaica and I was such a fish out of water. I remember going to the market in Mandeville, which is in the middle of Jamaica, and I didn't understand anything anybody said to me. I remember coming back to England. I mean, I loved being there. I mean, I felt roots, I felt everything, and music was amazing. I came back to England and realised that I'm something different. I didn't feel Jamaican anymore.
Yeah.
We were the first generation of black British people.
Yeah.
And we had to really find our way, right?
Absolutely. Well, the same thing happened where I grew up, which was Southall in West London, the big Asian community. Southall, of course, had its own you know, issues with the National Front that tried to march there.
Yeah.
But the community stood up, you know, and there's what people term the Southall riots, but I call it the Southall uprising, where people said, no way, fascists are not going to march our streets. And, you know, big fights ensued. And the young Asians burnt down the NF pub, the Hamburg Tavern. So that gave the community a big sense of identity, I think, and confidence. Mm. But it was also the beginning of the breaking between the parents' generation, who were the ones who'd come to England, who wanted to keep quiet and just work hard, you know, and provide for their kids, between young people who were saying, well, hold on a minute, we're not going to take the same stuff that our parents have taken.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to fight
exactly.
back. So I was kind of a bit young then to be part of that, but I stand on their shoulders, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that when my parents came over, every day was surviving.
Yes.
You know, they came over with qualifications, they could do all these different jobs, and they came to England and was like, oh, no, you have to re-qualify.
Yeah.
And I think it was just about putting food on the table and just getting through the day.
Absolutely.
And then we come along and we're brought up with a British sensibility of like, well, why should we be quiet? Why should we just stand back?
Yeah.
I kind of grab hold of the fact that I was this new thing, which was Black British.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
that was a whole new identity.
The music of the time, Lovers Rock and all that, that was very British Jamaican,
it
right?
It was our own sound.
Yeah.
You know, it was our own version of reggae music, you know, Afro-Caribbean music. I mean, for me, the beginnings of my music history was the connection I got, because my granddad had a nightclub.
Oh.
I'm not allowed to call it a shebeen. It's called the Effa Residential Club, but it was. And I remember growing up with this ska scene, and then it comes along Madness and the Specials, and that's why I got the connection, because it was like my granddad's music and my parents' music, but then this British music.
Amazing.
And that's how I kind of segued into British society using music.
Same with me. I mean, Specials were my band, because it was the first time I saw a band that I related to that had Black and white people in it together. That was the thing for me.
In an appreciative way, not an appropriating way.
Exactly.
It was a collective.
Yeah.
They were like a community and a group and a culture together.
And then for me, jumping forward a little bit from that, was the British Bhangra scene.
Ah.
So when the British Bhangra scene happened, that was it for me.
It's an explosion.
There was this fantastic fusion of Bhangra music, reggae, rock, house.
It was all
jazz, everything
mixed
all came together. And I remember thinking, wow, this is amazing, because this has been created by us, for us, but for everyone to enjoy. And so I made my first film, I'm British Buck, because it was the first consolidation for me of what a British Indian identity was. And that music then went on to change the landscape of music in Indian films.
Yes.
You know, had a massive impact. But for me, I'm ever grateful to it, because it gave me a sense of what being British and Indian meant.
Yeah, because you were born in Nairobi as well. Kenya.
Yes.
So you've got the Punjab side, and you've also got the British and the African.
Absolutely.
As well.
So my mum and dad were born in Kenya as well. My great uncle was asked by the British to leave Punjab, where he was a decorated police officer, and come to Kenya to help quell the locals after the scramble for Africa, basically.
Yeah.
And he devised a way of helping locals by planting new crops, so they had new boundaries, because all their old boundaries had been carved up.
Mm.
And then my granddad then went over to be with him. But my dad absolutely pined for Kenya, and he would speak in Swahili to us. And I think the thing about growing up with parents who are from Kenya gave me a very different experience to Indians growing up from India.
Yeah, because, I mean, you've got two kind of connected cultures, but very strong individual cultures in themselves.
Absolutely.
And then you take that, you come to England.
Yeah.
So, I mean, your identity crisis must have been...
Well, I would never call it a crisis. But it was...
Mine was a crisis,
was it? No, mine was always, they don't understand. When teachers would say to us, oh, they don't know if they're English or Indian, they don't know what to speak, they should all be speaking English at home. They don't know, they're having an identity crisis. And I would go, well, actually, I know, I'm obviously not going to speak in Punjabi with you at school, because you don't get it, I'm going to speak it at home. But also, interestingly, like, my best friends at school were, like, from Trinidad or from Grenada, and I learned about this whole big island, small island conflicts, you know, that was a big thing.
It's this kind of residue of colonialism.
Yes.
You know? I mean, when for us it was because my dad was very pale and my mom was a bit darker.
Ah.
So we always had that thing of like, You know, I was kind of paler than other members of my family, but I was darker than other members of my family.
Right.
So there's this weird dichotomy of kind of like, well, you're better because you're lighter and you're worse because you're darker.
Right.
I've never been in Jamaica and going to May Pen where my dad was from, and they were just so pale and they just refused to talk to me.
I was, oh, God.
You know, and that was my first, again, more identity issues because I was like, oh, so... And then there's this part of Jamaica that's rejecting me when it's in my... Myself, I
yes.
I was Jamaican through and through. And it took me a while to get back to being Jamaican again.
You know, I completely identify with that because when I went to India, I first went to India when I was about 8 years old with my mum, and I absolutely refused to eat the food, to do anything. And my poor grandma had to make me chips every day. Oh, I was ridiculous. But it's only when we go to these countries, like when I go to India, I realise how English I am.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And I've made lots of movies in India, you know, and I love it for what it represents and stands for, you know, in the world in terms of spirituality and culture. I mean, it's an amazing country. But is it my country?
Yeah, you recognise that you're once removed.
Yes, you know? I do, yes.
I'm like you, I loved it. I remember my great-grandma lived on the top of a really tall hill and she'd go up and down the hill like it was nothing to you. She was like 86 or something. My granddad had this old Jeep that when you drived, it had this big crack down the middle that would kind of open and close as you were driving. I remember being scared and kind of like excited at the same time.
Yeah. Well, now as I get older, I don't have so much conflict about am I this, am I that or the other, because I just go with the flow now.
Yeah.
You know, India is a part of me. I made a film on the partition of India. It's the land of my grandparents. Mm. Kenya, East Africa is the land of my parents. You know, England's the land of my kids who are actually part Japanese, American, Indian, God knows.
Yeah.
So I think that the world is a much smaller place and we do better to get away with these regional boundaries and territories and be much more global.
Exactly. We've kind of taken our place and we didn't wait for it to be given to us and that's what we've built. I think we're going to get some questions.
Yes, because I think I'm really interested to know where all these people are from who have been watching us because they're from all over the world. Hello, what's your name? What's your question?
Hi, my name is Devashree and I'm from Mumbai, India. So my question is that why do you think is music or musical hybridity so important for diasporic artists or people in terms of giving them their voice and identity?
Well, music for me is emotion. It effortlessly is hybrid,
just by
its very nature. It's a confluence of so many influences. So it totally speaks our language if you're part of a diaspora. So for me, the idea of being able to lock into different expressions of people's culture and blend them represents who I am.
For me, I find that because music has so much emotion to it, it's a great connector. It's the one thing that everybody on the planet can connect to and feel from their heart. It's just this wonderful thing that comes out of us that we can translate these feelings to everybody.
And for film, what's great when I use music in film is it allows me to layer up. So by using a fused sound of music, then you add pictures and film sound to it and you get something very exciting.
Hi, my name is Bruce and I'm from South London in Brixton.
Ah, my manner.
Yeah. my question is for skin. Being both black and a woman, which one of these identities did you find more of a hindrance navigating a white male-dominated industry such as music?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it's impossible for me to separate those things. Mm. They are all together, all at the same time. So, especially when I'm dealing with other people who are not so positive towards me in those days, I don't know which one it was. Was it because I was black, or was it because I was gay, or was it because I was female? I think it's just a whole thing people's had some issues with and not necessarily one thing or more than the other.
Hi, I'm Allegria. I'm in London. It's lovely to see you both.
You too.
As two women, especially two women who aren't white, have you ever felt that internally, so within the Asian community or within the black community, there were further expectations of how you should behave?
Of course. That's what Bendy Like Beckham was about. Yeah. You know, there is this expectation for all parents that their children should be kind of like them. You know, it doesn't matter who you are, which background, which race, which class, whichever. Yep. All parents kind of feel safe that their kids are kind of replicas of them. Obviously, with us, when our parents are immigrants or have come, you know, from somewhere else, we carry the guilt of trying to make their life feel worthwhile and their struggles to give us a great education, you know. But my parents, when they realised I wasn't going to be a doctor, you know, or a lawyer, and I wasn't going to get married at, you know, 23 or something, I think they took that in their stride, actually, and they and I was able to take them with me on my journey. So, you know, I think we're going to always keep pushing boundaries for what you believe in and what is authentic to you.
And then one further question for Skin. Now, as you go on, there are less Black female stars who are allowed to, I guess, be a bit outlandish or be rock stars. Were you ever frustrated yourself and felt the need to go to America? Or is the UK kind of, in its own eccentric way, felt like a safe space at times?
I think that the impression of what Black women are supposed to do in this country in England is very small. It's either you're highly sexualized or you're highly aggressive. Mm-hmm. And I think it's this very small sphere that society puts on us. And I decided at a very early stage, after trying to fit in and trying to be either of those things, actually, I didn't try to be aggressive, actually. I was just singing rock songs, a bit aggressive. I discovered that I'm not the girl next door, so stop trying to be, like, you know, a white boy rocker. And once I kind of let go of that, then that's really when everything fell into place. You know, the racism and the sexism is still so strong that it is more difficult, I think, because there's this impression, which is wrong, that Black people fronting rock bands is not going to sell or it's not going to be as popular, you know. I was hardly on any covers of magazines because they thought, oh, it's not going to sell. I mean, my viewpoint was just to try and prove them, like Gurinder said, you just do what you're doing and you prove them wrong. Thank you. Great question.
Really awesome discussion so far. Gurinder, I wanted to ask you about your segment in the film Paris Je T'aime. It really spoke to me, not only as a Muslim woman, but also as someone of mixed French heritage. And it offers such interesting insight into the issues of identity, which you've both spoken a lot about today. Unfortunately, today's France is somewhat different. And the main character in Paris Je T'aime, Zarka, today she might have to remove her hijab. So I wanted to ask you, how do you feel about how the country has changed since you made Paris Je T'aime? And what are your thoughts on the rise of the extreme right in the world today? And as artists and creatives, do we have a role or responsibility towards combating hurtful and divisive narratives?
So Paris Je T'aime is a film where about 18 different directors all get to make a short, 10-minute short, and we can make it on anything we want. And so they asked me, and I immediately thought, well, it's got to be something to do with the hijab, because that was the big thing at the time being debated. And what I did was a sort of love story between a girl who's got a hijab on and a French boy, Francois. And what happens is Francois is with another boy who gives her a slur, basically says France for the French. And he says, why have you got this on when you're covering all your beautiful hair, you know? And she responds and saying, it's my choice, you know. I keep my hair for myself for when I want to use it for other people to see how beautiful I am. But this is me and it's my identity. And they end up having a conversation. So it's, again, it comes down to fear, really, fear of the unknown. And I think that it's important as much as we can, certainly, is to always bring everything down to the common denominator as humans. And in that film, that's what I was trying to do, was just bring them back down to the fact that they're both French. And in terms of the rise of the right, I think, yes, there is a rise of the right, but there's also a rise of the left, you know, and that will always be the case. And we must take solace in that, you know, in the fact that people will always be there to fight fascists.
I mean, I what I feel about it is the right are very organised. They are kind of like this huge, big force, this army putting feelers out all over the world, starting little groups all over the world and trying to directly influence people in power. Whereas left-wing people, Sometimes I feel like we get caught, so caught up in ourselves and finding ourselves. Well, these guys here are just like marching forward, really, you know, strong. Like they're the tortoise and we're the rabbit going around in circles. And so I would like to see a lot more strength in numbers, because if we don't, then we'll have it be in a situation where suddenly, you know, countries are like dominoes and all have fascist and right-wing and white supremacist governments in about 5 years' time.
Thank you.
Does that answer the question?
The whole reason I came into making films was because I wanted to challenge the fact that we were absent from the screen and therefore absent from history.
For me, writing about politics or writing about political things really was just writing about my personal experience.
We are the recorders of our voices as people of the diaspora, and because they're there, they can't be taken away.